Welcome to Croxley Green Baptist Church Sermon Podcast. There are so many versions of that carol, that Advent song, and yet each of them have that sense of anticipation, that sense of yearning for Emmanuel. I don't know if you know anybody called Emmanuel. It's not a common name, is it, these days? We've got one group of friends who one of their children is called Emmanuel. And it's particularly poignant because they've had five children and they've lost three of them. Mm-hmm. And Emmanuel came at the end of processing some of that grief. They're obviously still living in that grief, but there's a real sense, isn't there, in that name, of God with us, even in the darkest times. And I think that's why, for me, that carol, you know, it's so important for Advent and what Advent means for us. But I don't know what Advent means to you. We would like it, wouldn't we, to be this peaceful waiting. But I think more often it is a frantic ticking off of items on a list. The ever-growing feeling of anticipation and stress as the days disappear. And with them, your time to buy and plan and prepare the perfect Christmas. My daughters love that Kirsty's homemade Christmas program. And it just fills me with an absolute sense of doom, anything like that, because that's not how my Christmas will ever be. Maybe that's why my girls like it, because it's just something so foreign to what our Christmas normally is. So what is Advent supposed to mean for us? Well, I've got some quotes from some pretty important theological people. Pope Benedict says this: Advent increases our hope, a hope which does not disappoint. The Lord never lets us down. The word Advent means expectation. What Advent can do for us is create a sense of hope. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is one of my favourite theologians and heroes of the faith, we went to Berlin in September for a mini break, and I was so excited we stumbled across the church where he was ordained. Mm-hmm. And to go in there, and of course it's been rebuilt because it was bombed, but just to have that, there's a plaque outside to him. If you don't know much about him, I encourage you to find out about him. He is an incredible person. But he says this: the celebration of Advent is possible only to those who are troubled in soul, who know themselves to be poor and imperfect, and who look forward to something greater to come. That really helps me when I think about my Christmas not being perfect like Kirsty's homemade Christmas. I need to know that actually, to really anticipate Advent, we need to know that we're poor and imperfect. And Stanley Harris says this: Advent is patience. It's how God has made us a people of promise in a world of impatience. And it seems to me that all of these quotes all hint at a season of waiting in a world of impatience, and a season of waiting in silence. And as often happens when the Lord is at work, it is almost as though Claire had read my sermon in the words that she was saying to lead us into this service. Another quote that I came across which really struck me was from St. John of the Cross, who was a 16th century mystic, and he said, "Silence is God's first language." Silence is God's first language. And yet, it is a language that most of us fail to understand, isn't it? Or even try to learn. Our lives are so full of information pressing in at every moment via our phones, our TVs, even our own thoughts. that to pursue real silence is a frightening and foreign thing. And yet Advent is all about silence and waiting. Not because God is some capricious being who loves to keep us hanging on the line like some particularly infuriating call centre. No, because there is something immeasurably rich in the silence and the waiting that he in his goodness doesn't want us to miss out on. And pastoral vacancy is an Advent season of its own, isn't it? There is the very real temptation to rush into the next chapter of what God has for us, and yet that would mean missing out on the richness of waiting on him and the joy of an answer in the fullness of time. And so as we enter into Advent and in the midst of pastoral vacancy, we can pray, O come, Emmanuel, with all our hearts and yet still live in the moment of what the waiting brings and the silence tells us. So I want to help us to think about that this morning by suggesting that there are three D's of looking for Emmanuel. I know that having three things and having them all begin with one letter is a very Spurgeon thing to do. I don't actually think I've ever done it before, so I don't know quite what came over me, but anyway. So I want to suggest that Emmanuel seems delayed, that Emmanuel can be disruptive, and Emmanuel is always defining. So Emmanuel seems delayed. Well, Isaiah's words spoken around 735 BC are full of hope. Despite being part of the first section of Isaiah that warns of exile and destruction, and in fact, I think that's why I like that version where it says, all right then, because it's in the middle of a whole rant where God is warning his people that they've turned their back on him and that what is coming is being removed from their homeland, separation from God. And yet, these words of Isaiah take 735 years to come to fruition. And in anybody's eyes, that's a long time to wait, isn't it? It's a very long time for a promise to come good. So why the delay? Why doesn't God act there and then? And what about the 400 years of absolute silence between the last prophet and the carpenter Joseph having his strange dream in downtown Nazareth? What is it about the waiting that is so important? Well, I think it's perhaps helpful to look at the personality of Joseph and to see what those 735 years have grown in him. What we see in Joseph is a quiet, faithful, ordinary man who knew his scripture. He knew enough of the law to know that he shouldn't and couldn't marry Mary. But he also knew the lawgiver well enough to want to be kind about his dismissal of her. He knows that in a small town, he would never, ever be able to shake off the scandal of marrying Mary when she is already pregnant. And so doing so was unthinkable for a godly man like Joseph. But this is a kind, loving man, and one who knows what this might mean for Mary. And so he tries to do it quietly, to spare her the scorn and the imminent danger of being found out. And yet, all it takes for this devout man to make a decision that will be social suicide for him is one dream. One slightly strange vision in his sleep, which I think most of us would have put down to cheese, probably. Mary's story of an angel plus this dream is enough to convince Joseph that he has really been asked to look after the mother of the Messiah and be his earthly father. That is a huge level of expectation right there. No one makes a decision like that with so many consequences, and there were consequences for Joseph and for Mary. Right in the middle of Jesus' ministry, people are still asking with a wink, isn't this Joseph's boy? Or is it just Mary's son?
Mm.
No one makes a decision like that with those kind of consequences unless you have inherited a whole load of faith and expectation and you live in the reality of it yourself. You see, Joseph and Mary were the perfect couple for God's plan because they had inherited all those years of waiting. And they were looking and waiting for God's promises to come true in silent expectation. Expectation is the fruit of silence and waiting. The silence gives God the chance to tell us what to look for, and the waiting gives time for expectation to grow. So I'm standing here smelling nice things. I'm reminded that expectation is almost like a physical response, isn't it? When we smell nice things and we wait for a lovely lunch, our body responds, doesn't it, by making our mouth water, and the food that is promised is so much nicer for the waiting, isn't it? So it is with God. Emmanuel still looks for people with silent and expectant hearts. He still needs people who are prepared to look and wait. People like Joseph, who are full of faith and are faithful to the promises of old. I wonder what we are waiting on. I wonder if we have stopped looking and waiting for what God might do in our lives. I wonder whether our expectation of God has increased or maybe diminished with the wait. But Emmanuel can be disruptive. So after 400 years of silence and 735 years since Isaiah's prophecy, Emmanuel breaks into history. And like most first babies in a family, he brings disruption. The quiet life of looking and waiting, building a local business and marrying the local girl is suddenly thrown into chaos by this immense burden and responsibility. Not only will the scandal of this baby follow Joseph and his family for the rest of their lives, the consequences of who he is will bring upheaval and danger to both him and Mary. Joseph responds to this disruption decisively. He gets up from his unsettling night and does exactly what the angel has told him to do. And Luke tells them that they have to move to Bethlehem. The prophecies which offered hope and comfort to Israel bring the opposite to this young family. They become refugees. They have to move. They have to leave all of their support networks as they prepare to be parents. And we would be well advised to be warned by their experience, because at no point does Jesus promise us anything less than disruption. To learn to die to self every day and to pick up one's cross is to resign oneself to a life of disruption. Emmanuel is never convenient, never soothing, never comfortable. He is always inconvenient, always challenging, always disturbing. And yet, for those who have been watching and waiting, he is the only one worth all of that disruption. He is the one who somehow disrupts and places everything where it should always have been. The priorities of life before God with us are easily forgone, aren't they, in the light of the miracle of Emmanuel. But I wonder what parts of our lives might Emmanuel need to disrupt this Advent. What comfortable patterns have become deaf to his challenge? What might we need to give up in order to take up our part in the story of God come down to human beings? But Emmanuel is always defining. Now, what we know from the genealogy of Matthew's Gospel is that Joseph's father was called Jacob. He comes from the line of David, and yet locally he is much more likely to be known as Jacob's boy. With the arrival of Emmanuel, Joseph's position in history is defined. Who he is, his character, and his faith are part of the story, but also where he's come from. His family history is what fulfills other prophecies and makes him the right earthly father for the Son of God. And everything that Joseph thought had defined him up to that point, his faithful attendance at synagogue, his skilled profession, his upcoming marriage, his family's standing in the village, none of that tells us who he is now. Because from now on, he is defined by Emmanuel. Joseph will always be defined by his relation to Jesus. Not just in the millions of nativity plays for children with tea towels on their heads, acting out the earthly father of Jesus, but in terms of the whole story of God's love for us, he is defined as the earthly father who said yes to God. And this is the one experience that we all share with this brave young couple 2,000 years away in a small outpost of the Roman Empire. They seem so far away from our experience, don't they? But this is what we share with them. When we accept the invitation of Emmanuel, we are defined by him too. Nothing we thought of as important matters anymore except who we are in him. We might come from the most amazing family line. I don't know anything about your backgrounds. You might have all sorts of famous people in your backgrounds. You might have really skilled jobs and be great achievers. And yet what matters more than anything else in the universe is who we are in relation to this baby. This baby defines us as the recipients of grace, the benefactors of a God who came to live amongst us. This baby tells us that we are in need and only he can help us. He exposes us as the failures we are and yet defines us as daughters and sons of the King. I wonder who or what is defining us this Advent. What untruths and misconceptions have been spoken over us or play in the continued loop in our head? What might Emmanuel want to whisper quietly in our ears if we would just stop, be silent, and wait on him? Are we prepared to be delayed, disrupted, and defined by this Emmanuel? Can the pressing priorities of a world made deaf by its own noise be quietened in this season of silence and waiting, so that we can recalibrate and replace ourselves in the story of Emmanuel? As I said, all this took place to fulfill what the Lord has said through the prophet. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. I'm going to read those definitions of Advent again, and then I'm going to give us a time to just hold silence, to wait on Emmanuel, to see what he might have to say to us. Advent increases our hope, a hope which does not disappoint. The Lord never lets us down. The word Advent means expectation. What Advent can do for us is create a sense of hope. The celebration of Advent is possible only to those who are troubled in soul, who know themselves to be poor and imperfect, and who look forward to something greater to come. Advent is patience. It's how God has made us a people of promise in a world of impatience. Silence is God's first language.